Hello and welcome to the Vassals of Kingsgrave. We are back this time around to continue our ongoing reread of the Harry Potter series of books. You may have heard of them. In this, the ninth podcast, we'll pick up our reading of The Goblet of Fire, covering chapters 11 through 20, starting with Aboard the Hogwarts Express. My name is Zach, also known as Alias on the podcast of Ice and Fire forums, and joining me we have...
I'm Abby, also known as Stacey Wormut.
This is Adam, Drowned Snow on the forums.
Hey everyone, this is Mary, or Nymeria on the forums.
Farley on the forums, Matt in real life.
And this is Michal and Azarine on the forums.
Excellent. Thank you all so much for joining me for this. So just a reminder, as always, for anyone listening, that this podcast is full of spoilers for everything in the Harry Potter universe, including The Cursed Child and the Fantastic Beasts films. Are we getting another one of those? Is that a thing that's happening?
Sure.
Okay.
Technically, but I think they, like, sent the script back or something.
It's like Star Wars right now. It's just in production hell permanently. Nothing is certain.
Yeah, they fucked it up and then they don't know how to get it back.
Yeah.
I think Star Wars is in a better place than the Fantastic Beasts.
Maybe, yeah. All I know is, like, the whole Obi-Wan show is now fucked up too, right? So
that's Captain Kennedy being a dummy.
Okay. Maybe. All right. Enough of that. We've talked enough about that in recent podcasts. Let's go ahead and jump into our chapters here. So we'll be covering kind of the middle part of the book when things are ramping up. We arrive at Hogwarts, which is always fun, and we go through up to the first task, which is the, of course, Triwizard Tournament. The big event for this novel should be fun, but before that, we got to do all the setup. So I'll be covering the first two chapters that we have, which are Chapter 11, Aboard the Hogwarts Express, and Chapter 12, the Triwizard Tournament. So Chapter 11, not too much to talk about here, really. We get this little episode with Mad-Eye and the exploding dustbins, of course, setting up the mystery of him being replaced. I think that's the moment where that happens. And we learn you can put toast into the mouths of someone using the flu network, so that's fun. Anything on this part of this chapter? Not too much to say, really.
So, is this like a proto Order of the Phoenix, or are they, like, the Weasleys already on board? Because like he rushes off to have Mad-Eye like they're like old friends or something.
Oh well, I think it's more of a Ministry thing here. It's Amos kind of tips him off about this, and that's why he helps out, because he's the best. Because Arthur is the best person to make this kind of a seem like a minor offense, right?
I thought it was also to protect Mad-Eye, because he wants to minimize the impact of the incident for him. So I think probably they're old friends, or at least they know, or Arthur Weasley knows that Mad-Eye was a big defender of the good side, and that you want to protect him.
Yeah, that's kind of why he'd be willing to go out.
Yeah,
his way.
I mean, Molly says that they're like, you know, he's a fan or whatever.
Yeah, but he thinks very highly of him. And the all-timer from Fred, well, Dad collects plugs, doesn't he?
But I mean, he was around the last time Voldemort was, you know, busy. Yeah. So
yes, so they do have a previous relationship and they're willing to help each other out. That makes sense. Yeah, good little tease of that. Yeah, speaking of teasing, everyone keeps teasing that something is going to happen at Hogwarts as we go through up to the point where everyone gets on the train, and we hear it from the parents, we hear it from Malfoy, everyone knows something, and people are pissed about it. So yeah, that's what's happening. Anything on the train, anything on going up to Hogwarts? I didn't think so. There's not really much.
It's raining. I do appreciate the atmosphere every time when it's like, you know, we had a really nice day last night, and then like, oh crap! It's school. Like, yeah. Decidedly lack of vacation air that's going on.
Yeah. And I loved the way they need to be careful about not being seen by muggles when they go through the wall thing. So they're like casually chatting and sliding into it.
That just makes me think of like the logistics nightmare of how long this would take to
slowly to get everyone hundreds there. of children. Yeah.
All right, so they can go ahead and go to Chapter 12, the Triwizard Tournament. We get the start of term feast, and this is somehow the first sorting that Harry will get to watch. Nothing too much there. We get a song. We get a new Sorting Hat song about the founding of Hogwarts. This is probably the least important song that he shares, but it's fun to hear, I guess. We see Dumbledore clearly ruminating on the poor weather. It seems more obvious than ever that there is some kind of sign of darker things to come for this story, and we do get more of that later with Sirius, you know, remarking on like signs that he is seeing that something is afoot. That's probably more about Bertha Jorkins, but Dumbledore is not happy about the weather. He doesn't like that. We get Dennis Creevy's excitement about falling in the lake and the giant squid, and that's very refreshing, just his bald-faced excitement about being at Hogwarts. That's great. And the big thing, you know, we get Hermione finding out that house elves are the ones making the Hogwarts food. So shit's getting real for Hermione. She's going to be on a crusade pretty soon. Of course, at the end here, we get Mad-Eye Moody arriving, making his grand entrance.
It's funny to me because he makes such a villain entrance.
Yeah, with the lightning striking and all that.
Yeah. But like, we just kind of go along with it.
Yeah, it's actually really well done. When I'm reading through this again, just how, you know, I don't think how you could guess that he's like a different person entirely that we haven't met, but it's so well hidden, even knowing that it's somebody else. Like, you just have no idea that this could be the person.
It bothers me though, because she built up his character as someone we kind of not necessarily like, but someone who makes sense, and we want to. He does things that we like. Like at some point, Harry in the next few chapters, I think, thinks, he told Neville that he was good in botany or whatever, and that's the kind of thing Professor Lupin would have done, and he remarks that it's a good thing. So it bothers me how I'm inclined to like this character, even knowing that it's not him.
There's like some things though, like that one I kind of understand, because like he wants to get Harry the information about the Gillyweed later. Yeah. So he gives the book to Neville, and like also he's Barty Crouch, so he like, you know, let Neville along by him, and he's like, haha, I can bask in this kid's uncomfortableness. But there are like other things that happen like later on, and I was just kind of gonna actually ask this question. Are there times when it's actually Moody and Barty Crouch is like imperiousing him or something? Because like in the chapters that I covered, there is a lot of stuff that Moody does that just like, or Barty Crouch does, that just seems like really counterintuitive to his plan. So like,
yeah, I felt the same. Yeah, we'll get to that, but I do think just on the point about helping Neville, yeah, that actually seems like, you know, deeply malicious to me. Just like the idea of like consoling the kid whose parents he tortured, just like, oh my god, it's so evil.
Well, I mean, that whole scene, I mean, yeah, we'll get to it, but that whole scene is just such a mind fuck for Neville, deliberately, I think.
Yeah, it's so evil.
Oh, I have to blow up the spider.
Yeah. Is that in this chapter? No, that's the next chapter. Okay. Yeah, it is the next. I had some stuff I wanted to talk about, but that's for next chapter. So
two chapters. Two chapters.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah.
We'll this is chapter 13, where we always meet our villain slash.
Is that true? I didn't know.
Yeah,
that.
I think so. Yeah.
Oh wow.
Interesting. Yeah, the only other thing in chapter 12, and we'll move on, is of course the Triwizard Tournament is introduced. Ron, Fred, and George are really excited about the idea of that 1,000 galleon prize, and trying to find a way past that age line that will be set. Harry, you know, he's just fantasizing about Cho. That's what he's about.
That feels so random to me. Maybe I'm just like forgetting something earlier in this book, but like where he thinks about Cho, but like all of a sudden it's like,
well,
Cho.
In the last book, I think they there's some stuff. Oh, right?
Okay. My brain probably just like completely forgot about it. But
I don't think so. In the last book, maybe.
She's probably they play in Quidditch, right?
Yeah, and Harry felt like a swooping sensation in his stomach that had nothing to do with nerves.
Oh, okay. Never mind then. It's a little precedented.
It's like a three-book crush. Serious business. Even though they don't last very long. All right.
They flame out so spectacularly fast.
Oh, yeah. One date. All right. Let's do chapter 13 and 14, which will be you, Matt, taking us
through this. All right, so the kids are going to classes. They start off at Herbology, not Botany, Marie, where Professor Sprout apparently can't say anything without adding bubo tubo pus in it. Then on to Care of Magical Creatures with Hagrid, where they meet the Scroots, and they know the female Scroots and the male Scroots, and because one has a stinger and one has some kind of suctiony thing on the bottom belly, it's really gross. And then they go to divination, where Lavender Brown asks a question of Trelawney, and Ron asks to see her anus, and she waits two books to do that.
Oh, man.
Ron, please.
What? What happened, guys? We're all friends here. So Malfoy's a little shit again, points out that Mr. Weasley's in the paper about the Mad-Eye incident. They even misspell his name, indicating that he really is a nobody in the ministry. And after some wicked taunts back and forth, Malfoy decides to try to attack Harry. Mad-Eye Moody sees this, turns Malfoy into a ferret, bounces him off the concrete, says don't attack anyone with their back turned, and then Professor McGonagall stops him. So I guess the only thing about this chapter is that we get kind of Harry ruminating about divination and how even though Trelawney is a fraud, he thinks that, you know, what she said last year was true. Anything else?
We get another Moody thing here, him turning Malfoy into the ferret. Which is kind of a tell, I guess, that he's not on the up and up, and of course there'll be some more weirdly questionable choices later made by him, but it also shows an early moment where he's favoring Harry, which we of course get the inverse of later when Snape kind of clearly supports Malfoy. So
speaking of poor choices, in the book they don't say that the ferret just gets bounced around, but in the movies for some reason Mad-Eye puts the ferret down, either Crab or Boyle or whoever, down his pants. So
it's humorous. It's
what did Malfoy give a little ferret hand job to one of his buddies?
What?
Maybe he did. Maybe he didn't. We don't know. We didn't see.
Oh my god!
Is anyone what?
I'm very glad I didn't see those movies. For many reasons.
For many reasons, yeah.
Bet you didn't think you'd hear a ferret hand job.
You didn't see
today.
Those movies?
I feel like we go over
no,
this
every
time.
No, I only saw the first one.
Michal is against the movies.
But you just gave up after the first one?
Yeah. I mean, kind of unfairly, because I was, I don't know, 14, 13, and, you know, made a whole list of things that were wrong from the books that I wouldn't probably care about now, because I know how adaptations work, but I'm still kind of like, you know what, I got my own version of all this stuff, and the only real downside is that when I go to Harry Potter World, I'm a little bit like, wait, what? Mm. Like, is that how that looks?
Yeah.
Why is there a frog choir?
Yeah.
Ferret thing, though. I find that actually, like, really sinister, even without the pants thing.
Say it.
the ferret hand job that Matt elucidated.
The little paw job. I it's one of those things that I actually think she handles for the most part really well, because, like, we the external signs of, like, if you look at the stuff Moody does, most of it's like, yeah, this is fucked up. Why does Dumbledore want him here? Like, this is, something's not right. And then, like, but because we get those signs of, you know, like, approval from Dumbledore and, like, the, you know, the idea that, like, something was like what Professor Lupin would have done, which, in my opinion, is, like, the complete inoculation of anything that, that Moody does next, because we love Lupin.
And, of course, it's all for Harry, right? He's such a helpful person to Harry, so we're primed as the reader to be like, oh, that's good. That's good. He's kind of weird, but he's helping our guy.
Yeah, but if you look at it objectively, it's, like, actually really disturbing. And, like,
yeah, I mean, like he puts him under the Imperius curse, but oh, he teaches him how to break it, right? Like,
let's go ahead and go to that chapter, chapter 14.
Unforgivable curses. So they end chapter 13 talking about how cool Mad Eye Moody is, the twins do, and they kind of transition into Harry's first class with Mad Eye Moody, and in which he teaches them all unforgivable curses. He shows them on spiders, so we have the Imperius curse, which is a mind control kind of thing. The Cruciatus curse, which is a torture, pain inflicting curse. And of course, the death curse, Avada Kedavra, which ends a class really cool with Mad-Eye saying, you know, there's only one person who's ever survived this curse, and he's sitting in this room. Then we fast forward to the common room where Hermione starts the world's worst off storyline spew to protect house elves, and Harry receives a letter from Sirius saying he's heard rumors of Harry scar herding where he is, and he's returning to Britain, and that's where we end it.
So here is the unforgivable curses introduced that we probably, you know, we at least knew one of them. or had an idea of what one of them could have been.
Shouldn't there be more than three?
Yeah, probably. There's probably a lot of other bad ones.
Well, I mean, if you think about it, they're really like, the Imperious Curse is not exactly like rape, but it is kind of a loss of personal consent. And then you have torture, and then you have murder. So I feel like those are kind of like the big three, like, evil things that evil people do.
Yeah, but you would expect, like, other...
Like, where's, like,
other curses that you're not allowed to do, like, I don't know, to just... Because it would disrupt the order, the general order of things.
Yeah,
I don't know.
The whole concept doesn't... I mean, it's, like, oversimplification for, like, a child's book, I guess. Like, we have these three curses you can't do, but, like... I don't know, like the Imperious Curse, you think like, well, they would use it to control animals because they don't care about animals, right?
Well, it specifically, he specifically says like using them on a human is the unforgivable.
He does.
Oh, yeah, that's true. But I mean, and the Killing Curse, I always kind of bothered me because I was like, there's no way to defend against it. Like, it's kind of cheating. But,
yeah, it is kind of bullshit, isn't it?
And it seems like it's easy to do. It's just whether or not people choose to do it.
No, it's not easy.
No, he explains it's very hard, and that if they all like try to do it to him right there, he would not feel a thing.
Yeah. Well, isn't it just the willpower, like the desire to kill is like all you need, right?
Maybe, yeah, but I don't know.
It's kind of unclear.
Perhaps it's like the willingness
which
to
I guess
split your sword.
You have to mean it, Potter.
My goodness.
Basically.
But yeah, I mean, like, there's a whole bunch of dark magics and stuff we know that they're not supposed to mess with. It's frowned upon, but I guess they don't get you a lifetime in Azkaban.
Yeah, I mean, who knows? Last book, Harry blew up his aunt. That's gotta be, like, unforgivable.
I think it's more, like, from, like, a legal perspective, these are the three, oh god, what is, okay, it's not reverse onus, it's the three oh my gosh, I just had a case on this and I cannot remember the word. I feel like a poop. But there's like in Canada when
we
like,
don't know, so just make something up.
Okay.
Say something in Latin, we'll buy it.
Well, I can't remember anything now. But basically I was just covering a case that is about child sentencing, and like obviously the unforgivable curses apply to everyone, but the idea is in Canada, this has actually changed a little bit now, but at the time of this case, the idea was if a youth commits a certain crime, like specific crimes, they get tried as an adult. And so like the three crimes are assault, murder, manslaughter, and like egregious bodily harm, like sexual assault and egregious bodily harm. So it, you know, it kind
of. So it's like they automatically are tried as an adult.
Well, now no, but at the time this case, because this was a Supreme Court level case which changed this. But at the time, yes, they would automatically be tried as an adult, and they would have to apply to be tried as a youth. But just in general, that's the background to the fact that it kind of does make sense that there are these like three curses, because like I'm just like relating it to what I know, but like in that sense, it makes sense that there are certain things, like obviously we categorize every kind of crime, but there are like these are the three major ones that like have specific ramifications associated with them that are like at the peak, and then below obviously there are probably other curses that you can't, you know, you don't get, like you probably could get like lifetime in Azkaban for, but they have more leeway.
It's like a case by case basis thing.
And maybe also by like elevating these to a certain level, you kind of make others more acceptable. Like, maybe this is, like, the sort of compromise where someone was like, yeah, those three are the really bad ones. And, like, you know,
lobbying,
I'm over here raising
the
dead. Don't worry about it.
Romancy like, lobby.
There are, like, you know, defensible reasons to use other curses, you know? Not really.
These are all motivated by some sort of evil.
Yeah. But, I mean, at the same time, like, Wizarding Justice is, like,
it's
not
a disaster. Yeah.
Obviously, they didn't have a Jack Bauer in the Wizarding world, that's all I'm going to say.
Well, it's like... robbery is a crime, but like robbery is on a different level, you know. I could osseo something, and you know, so it's like that, you know, it's on a different level than these three like these three spells. They're always used specifically for
right.
So like robbery with like it'd be like armed robbery rather than just robbery or something. It's like some kind
well,
of
well no I I'm just, you know, like the bat bogey or boogie hex or whatever, you know. Like,
so I guess it's like saying that, if you took a bat and you mugged someone with a baseball bat, you're like, well, you can also use that to play baseball, so we can't ban baseball bats.
Yeah, exactly. But they're called presumptive offenses, which are murder, attempted murder, manslaughter, and aggravated sexual assault.
Gotcha.
Those are all good ones to be tried as an adult for. I think.
Yeah. According to the Youth Criminal Justice Act.
Two of the unforgivable curses.
He does.
No one cares. The Wizarding Courts, certain curses are considered especially heinous.
Dun dun.
Wait, when does he use the Imperious Curse?
In the last book.
Yeah, yeah. I forgot.
And on the goblins.
But they're not humans, so it doesn't matter.
Well, no, he uses it on
the guy.
Ministry members when they're breaking into the ministry. Yeah.
And he doesn't really, like, successfully cast Cruciatus, right? Because, like, he can't do it.
Yeah.
For some reason.
Weak at that.
He wasn't angry enough.
He didn't mean it, says, right?
I think he really meant it. I just think he was too pure-hearted. is the idea that we're supposed to get.
Yeah, yeah. All right, so the thing that surprises me, though, is that, you know, for, like, a madman who has no training at anything, he's a pretty good teacher. Like, he's got a good lesson plan here.
Well, like, he was, like, so, I assume he had underlings that he had to...
Tongs, right?
Lay down the facts, you know?
I mean Barty Crouch Jr.
I assume
Moody didn't have any, like, lesson plans set up or anything, you know?
Yeah.
Like, because he had just received the offer, right?
Maybe he took them. Well, the whole thing is, like, he's extracting information from Moody, right? That's the whole thing.
Yeah, but still, like, how long ago did they know that Moody was going to be the next teacher and that they would take his place? It's a bit fuzzy, well, but it's crazy that it's crazy to me that he can just spend the whole year teaching classes every day and that it isn't weird.
Yeah, and like Dumbledore, anyone that knows him doesn't like him. Remember that one time, you know, when we saw that game or something, and he's like, yeah, sure.
Yeah.
I love how he always justifies his stuff with, like, Dumbledore wants you to do this.
Yeah.
No one bothered to check that. That was true. Hogwarts is a mess.
I mean, it is very, like, you know, when you tap into those authority things that, you know, that nobody's going to question. Like, and I actually like the idea that Barty Crouch is really good at playing Moody, because I think he's, like, he's so nuts that, like, I'm, like, imagining him being, like, this is the role of a lifetime, you know? Like, and, like, getting everything down and just, like, taking immense pleasure in fooling everybody as much as possible. I kind of buy that idea that he
just has, like, sort of a twisted natural talent that he is applying to this.
Well, I mean, he's doing it all innocent, for Voldemort, right? Like, his whole thing is, like, you know, oh, I'm just this innocent child who got caught in with Death Eaters for some reason, you know?
This is, like,
somehow just, like, ended up in the same room as, like, the Longbottoms and torturing them to craziness.
Here my wand accidentally did Crucio. Yeah.
If only he'd gotten into acting and not murder and torture, everything would have been fine.
Yeah. Do wizards have acting? Do we ever see a wizard play? Or
no, the only thing they're allowed to do is finish and gobstone.
So... we see here, I'm curious, you know, what do you guys think is Barty Crouch Jr.'s motivation for teaching the students about the Imperious Curse and eventually teaching them how to defend themselves against it? And I think you were mentioning something about that earlier, Abby, about it not being kind of clear why he's doing some of the things he's doing.
Yeah, so I was, in my chapter, I go more into this because my chapter is the one where he is training them.
Let's get into it, chapter 15.
Oh, are we on chapter 15 now?
We're in.
All right, well, chapter opens. So basically, we have Sirius, Harry is going to write a letter saying, oh no, Sirius, everything is actually okay, and I was just being silly, which is like the, like, least convincing letter ever.
Well, he thought a whole plan in his sleep, so.
Yes. So then they go back to class the next day, and Moody is going to now teach them how to resist the Imperious Curse, which will be... coming in handy later in either this book or a later book, I forget, because Harry is really, really good at it. And so, yeah, for this, I was just, like, so confused why Barty Crouch Jr. is trying to teach them to resist unforgivables, because this was also, I think, what I was cutting out earlier, what I was trying to say is, because I might be misremembering this, but wasn't he, like, all in on the Death Eater Brigade? And isn't that, like, why he doesn't like Karkoff and Malfoy? Because, like, they, like, pretended not to be in on that, and he, like, went to jail for what he believed in?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
But he is the most loyal Death Eater.
Like Malfoy and turns him into a ferret is not because he attacks Harry. It's because it's because of his dad.
Yeah. But so that's why I'm confused. Like, because if he wants Voldemort to rise again, like, why should he be teaching all these children how to, like, resist the unforgivables that the Death Eaters are presumably going
to
be casting? But what is the...
Is he just passing time?
Yeah.
There's other things he could be teaching them.
Like what?
Well, he wants to teach Harry enough to get to the middle of the maze, I guess. It could all just be that, but I don't know.
So, like, Moody acts happy when Harry does it, you know, but, like, I don't know that that's really his goal. I feel like he's just, like, slightly getting off on making these kids doing whatever he wants right under Dumbledore's
I wondered, too, is, like, can he place, like, a suggestion for later? Like, I mean, they said it, like, oh, he, like, releases him and throws it off, but is it possible that's not true? I don't really understand enough about the way it works.
I feel like that might be, because in the sixth book, when Malfoy has Madame Rose Myrta under the Imperius, doesn't he has her under it for, like...
We have plenty of examples of that, too, during the first war of people, like, being sleeper agents or being, like, under the cover for long periods of time where you couldn't have someone pointing a wand at them.
He could definitely be setting stuff up for later, you know, or, like, keeping them under the curse and just saying, see, I've released you, but... Like, you know, they don't know that for sure. They've been released.
Yeah, I think it's what Michal said, honestly. I think he just kind of gets off on it. He's just having fun. And he doesn't think of them as a threat, critically. He doesn't, like, think these kids are going to be a problem. So he's like, purely concerned about, like, putting Harry in the maze. He's going to get killed by Voldemort. Because how could Harry beat Voldemort, right? Once he's back, like, he has no conception that Harry could actually, like, win that.
Also just that I was also the extent of the Imperius that I was curious about what your thoughts were. Like, when he has Neville under it, he, like, is making him do all this gymnastics, and I'm obviously, and Harry says, like, Neville normally can't do this thing. So just, like, what is the extent, like, if the Imperius curse can make you do things that you're normally not physically capable of, just, you know, like,
well, it might be not things you're not physically capable of, but things you think you're not physically capable of, right? Like, you don't, it goes beyond all mental barriers of what you think you can do. All right, anything else? I mean, there's the big thing in this chapter, of course.
Yeah, but so that's the section is, you know, Harry can break the Imperius curse. Woohoo! Then also they go to the care of magical creatures and are taking care of these last-ended Scroots that get a lot of screen time, and I am just wondering, are they important later? I do not.
Okay, they're not important later. No. And I actually wonder, like, what thematically the point is of the Scroots.
That's a
good
point.
I've been thinking about this a lot because, like, the only thing that really made me think about this is that, like, we meet the Scroots right after we get this, like, very obvious, like, oh, the kids are growing up. They're going to get, you know, hormones and acne, you know, with, like, you know, squeezing the boobo tubers, and, like, it was disgusting but satisfying. And it's like, I feel like that's a very, you know, direct, you know, point on her part to be like, puberty is coming.
Plastic Scroots.
Yeah. And then writes itself. Like, the only thing I can come up with, and I could totally just be inventing this, you know, there might not be any thematic purpose to the Scroots at all. They might just be like, wow, Hagrid's a little crazy. But I almost wonder if they're, like, the counter to, like, cooperation, like what happens when you have, like, a whole bunch of, you know, because they start killing each other, and, like, kind of what happens when you have these extremely dangerous things that you keep nurturing, and yet, like, and you know, don't necessarily realize you're nurturing. I don't know.
I don't think they're meant to be anything besides, like, Hagrid fucking around and, like, to bring more heat down on him later on when, you know, they find out he's half-giant. Well, of course he's half-giant. That's why he's breeding, like, these, like, things that shouldn't be. And, you know, how awful they are. And...
Okay, then after that we get the big announcement that Durmstrang, I can never say this word, Durmstrang and...
Beauxbatons.
So we meet them. Madame Maxime, who is a giant, I guess her feet are apparently humongous, like child sleds are pretty freaking big, but okay. And then we meet Karkov, who is obviously being set up to be the distraction as the villain, because he's got this stereotypical goatee, and later on we, like, find out he was a Death Eater, and so obviously he's still a Death Eater. You know, we got, like, he's supposed to be the red herring. So my question for you guys is, which of the three wizarding schools would you guys want to be going to?
Hogwarts.
Hogwarts.
The other ones honestly seem awful. And Hogwarts is pretty bad too, but the other ones just seem like worse.
I think Bobaton seems great. I think it seems like a really good time.
Well, yeah, it's like the south of France, right?
Yeah,
exactly. Surrounded by like lavender fields or something.
I don't really like how they're portraying the French and the girls, if I may say.
They're all like very petty and self-centered, right?
That's my first note for the next chapter is I wrote French versus English.
Yeah.
The first thing I have for chapter 16.
This little boy doesn't belong here.
And then Hermione's like, these pansy French girls.
I know. Okay. I also have a like, okay, yeah, I might as well just move on to the next chapter because I have a lot of notes about this. So chapter 16 is The Goblet of Fire, and basically everybody is really excited that Victor Krum is here, because I forgot to mention that he went to Durmstrang in the last chapter, and it's a big deal because he's really popular, and Hermione does not like that he is always going to the library because now it's loud in the library. And Ron meets Fleur Delacour, who is very pretty for some reason. Nobody knows why everyone's attracted to her, but obviously she's a Vila, or part Vila, because we met Vilas earlier in the book. And then Dumbledore introduces the Goblet of Fire, which is how they are going to decide who is going to compete. And there is an age line that won't let anyone under the age of 17 cross. So RIP if your birthday was like the next day after, because you cannot participate. And Fred and George have that fun little time when they try to age themselves up, but then it reacts to them because they become old men instead of just being a couple of years older. And then everyone, what else happens? I think that's it, right?
That's pretty much it.
Yeah. So I remember, this is something I remembered from reading these books as a kid, was like, oh, there was a lot of ripping on the French. I don't know. Is it just like in the 90s? Was there, I know there's like a joke that, you know, like the French and the English don't get along, but like, I was just, you know, I was like, is it for humor? Or is it in the 90s? Maybe just French and English.
Well, I don't know if you know this, Abby. I mean, the 90s was still, we were in a colonial period back then, so.
All right, settle down.
It was a different time.
No, there's just a general enmity between England and France going back a bazillion years, right? Marie?
I really like them, but I think there are issues.
It's also like you're coming into this in a competitive, like it's automatically competitive, you know, like Dumbledore is literally the only one who is like, this has a higher purpose. And everybody else is like, we want
to. Because he's high as fuck, though. Like, he doesn't give a shit about any of this.
What does he do with all of his time?
Gets fucked up.
You know, he has those little puffing instruments in his office.
That pensive.
They're all just vaporizers. You know what Hagrid's growing.
So, on a more serious note, I thought that it was a bit absurd that the age line, it's a matter of age and not of what year you are at Hogwarts. Because why would someone who's like Fred and George, they will be 17 soon and they're in the same year. As like, I don't know, Angelina, and they, like, there's no reason that they would know less.
It's a liability thing. I think it's just because they're adults, right?
Because in the seventh book, Harry mentions that, like, wizards come of age when they're 17 because he gets the watch from the Weasleys. So.
Oh, that's right.
I think he's not
traceable or whatever, right?
Yeah, I think it's just, like, literally a wizard.
Except
thing.
He is, because he keeps saying Voldemort.
Dumbass. Another thing with this like French and English thing was just like Hermione does not see her character just seems to be like make no sense to me in the sense that she doesn't care about the Triwizard Tournament and like she's being rude to all the French students, but then she's really excited in the morning for the goblet and like she wakes up early like everybody else, and I just like cannot figure out what's going on. Like her character for some reason is just not consistent. That's what I'm thinking of. And it's just like, I don't know, something about it is just annoying me.
I don't know that it's not consistent. I think she's probably among the students the closest to Dumbledore's, like, you know, international unity and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And so I think, plus she probably has her own biases. I don't know, like, she keeps mentioning that, like, oh, she's been to France, FYI. So, like, I feel like it might be her.
How do you pronounce that soup?
People are supposed to act. Like,
bouillabaisse.
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 Okay.
The Abyss. I hate the Abyss. It's gross.
I was wondering what the blancmange dessert was that they were talking about.
I've never heard of it.
I missed that one.
Wait, I will check it out. I know what you mean, but I don't remember. Exactly.
Is it like a pot de creme?
It's a blancmange.
That would be weird.
It just means literally white eat. Yeah.
Well, yeah, it was like a pale sort of blancmange. I'm like, I know enough to know that blanc is similar to the word pale.
Yeah, I don't know. French version, it just says that one looked closely to some kind of weird white cream. And it doesn't say any name or anything that would make sense as to what it is.
Blancmange is a sweet dessert commonly made with milk or cream and sugar thickened with gelatin, cornstarch, or Irish moss. What? And flavored with almonds. It is usually set in a mold and served cold. Although traditionally white, blancmanges are frequently given alternative colors.
I have no idea what it is.
Yeah, so I guess it's similar to panna cotta.
Something it took me a long time to realize in this scene. And I always thought it was kind of dumb that, like, Fleur comes over and it's like, oh, you know, like, we have to introduce Fleur and we have to, like, confirm that, you know, she's a Vila or Ron is getting the Vila vibes from her. But I think, like, she just wanted to come over and see Harry. Like, I think that's why she comes over and is like...
Really?
Yeah.
You think she has a hots for her boy?
They don't have the same exact food on the Raven
Club. Yeah, it's absurd.
I totally missed that.
No, it was like, well, like it's especially since apparently all of the students from Bobbiton were sitting at the same table, which was not the Gryffindor one. So why would the French food would be on the Gryffindor table if there's only one table for the French food? Yeah.
Well, they just ate up. They ate their soup. I can't pronounce so fast.
Bouillabaisse.
Do you want to say it three times fast?
Bouillabaisse, bouillabaisse, bouillabaisse.
No, you don't pronounce that.
There's our bumper. We got it. Thank you, Matt.
Man, I haven't been to bumper in some time. You don't pronounce, thank you.
Yes. Okay, so then also something that was just a little nitpicky is like the Durmstrang students, when they're speaking to each other, they're speaking in English. And I don't know why, but that was like really random to me.
Yeah, I expected, especially if there's Hogwarts people nearby, that if they're trying to talk secretly about stuff, they would use a different language, but whatever.
Yeah, but remember, Durmstrang's an international school, so maybe they just have English as a one common language.
Point. That's a good point, actually.
And Karkaroff is clearly English, even though he's you know.
Clearly Russian.
His name is Karkaroff.
Yeah. Okay, then also, okay, this was just, like, maybe me being stupid, but does Karkaroff know that Moody is actually Barty Crouch Jr., or is he just scared of Moody because he's scared
of
Moody?
No, he doesn't know.
This is actually why I do really like the Moody thing, because he can get away with acting exactly like Moody would act to all these people for the exact opposite reason. And it kind of tickles me, like, him just being like, you know, I can pretend to be this, like,
right,
you know.
Like, when he's calling Snape and Karkaroff his old friend, there's, like, a double meaning apply. Yeah.
He could show, like, outward disdain without, like, really raising any flags.
I mean, he can act exactly as Moody would act in the way that Barty Crouch wants to act, except that, you know, or Barty Crouch Jr. wants to act.
Junior!
There's too many parties. yes. Yeah. But, the motivation is the opposite, which I enjoy.
Yeah, it's good stuff. It's just a really fun mystery. I just want to say I love how excited the Hufflepuffs are. There's so much to me like a small market sports team that finally got a star player. Like, they just have this one thing and they're gonna push it for all it's worth. I love it.
So has anyone seen
No.
Oh my god, okay, it's so good. I think it's filmed at some point, but it's like a Harry Potter, like, I guess spoof, but it's Harry Potter told from the perspective of the Hufflepuffs. So there's a narrator who introduces each year, and he's like, you know, year four, the time we finally mattered. And it's like, it's really sweet. And I highly recommend that show if anyone wants to watch it.
That's funny.
It actually made me cry because it's very, it's not just about the humor. It also has some, like, good emotions in it.
Well, I love in the Harry Potter musical when they're like being sorted and he's like, good guys go to Gryffindor, bad guys go to Slytherin, and the other people you can go whatever fuck you want, we don't care. No, but so actually speaking of houses, it's just like really this all chapter is also super interesting because even though they're the schools, it's supposed to be about like coming together as a school, it really emphasizes how divided Hogwarts is because of the house system. Like, especially after Harry gets chosen, which I guess is more chapter 17, but like the school is just split. Like, and then everyone, when it was first just Cedric, everyone was really disappointed that their person from their house was the chosen. And then like, obviously in the next chapter, Angelita is like, well, if at least we have a champion from Gryffindor, like they can't just be excited about their own house, their own school. Like it has to be still based on houses, which I think is
the Gryffindors can't let anybody else win anything. Like this,
they're
is,
the worst.
Like, yeah, they actually are really obnoxious. It's like Cedric,
they're like the Yankees.
Once and he's like persona non grata.
How are they like the Yankees?
I'm continuing my metaphor about the small market sports team. Like it's my whole thing I'm building up here. All right, chapter 17. So at the end of 16, we find out who the champions are, including.
Yeah, I forgot to mention that.
Including Harry Potter.
So why is the book named Goblet of Fire?
I don't know. It sounds kind of cool.
Yeah, but yeah. I mean, it's over. Like we saw it. That's it.
Yeah, but like the Order of the Phoenix isn't a really big deal in that book for most of it.
I don't think this was the original title. I like remember hearing some kind of Potter lore that like there was a different title.
To the interwebs.
Yeah, but I don't remember. I mean, it's a better title than like Harry Potter and the Triwizard Tournament, which would be but would sound lame.
Yeah, it's fine. I like it.
Well,
yeah,
it would be better if like the prize at the end was, you know, if the goblet was the.
The funny thing is, people get confused by that. That's like a weird kind of thing that happens. They think it is the prize because it is the title.
Well,
people
think
it's the trophy at the end.
It makes sense as a title because it's like the thing that kicks it all off.
Yeah, I definitely
because if
that.
Harry's name hadn't been chosen in the Goblet of Fire, then it would just be the Triwizard Tournament is happening around Harry. You know,
good lord.
Can you imagine reading that book where it's like Harry's just witnessing the Triwizard Tournament and nothing's happening at Hogwarts? Like,
all right, guys. So
probably should have realized earlier he'd be in it.
They had three alternate titles: Harry Potter and the Death Eaters, which is lame. Harry Potter horrible. And the Fire Goblet, which is stupid. And Harry Potter and Three Champions. I like the Three Champions. I think that would have worked.
But there are four champions.
Well, not including
Harry Potter and it's like a band name.
It's an incorrect title.
But there's only three champions alive at the end of the book.
Oh.
True that.
Galaxy Brain.
Boom. That's the universe brain or something. All right, chapter 17.
Okay, so yes, as I forgot to mention at the last chapter, Cedric Diggory, Victor Crumb, and Fleur Delacour all get picked as champions, and then dun dun dun, Harry Potter also gets picked as champions, and we realize, and all the 16-year-old students realize that they should have just asked their 17-year-old friends to put their name in the Goblet of Fire for them. Okay, so then Harry gets sent into the room, and everybody is really mad, and there's a big kerfuffle about how Harry should not get to compete, or everyone else should get to have an extra champion, but uh-oh, the Goblet of Fire went out, and it will not light again for one more year, and this is a magical contract that, for some reason, Harry has to compete. We don't know what would happen if he didn't compete, but it's just a magical contract that says he has to compete. Okay, so that's pretty much all that happens in this chapter. Okay, I don't really understand why it's such a big deal that Hogwarts has two, like, why, I mean, I understand it's, like, a pride thing, but, like, I don't know, like, just be like, we're hosting, so we get two, or something, like.
Well, they get two bets, that's the apple.
Yeah, but the school's already divided, like, everyone in that school hates each other if they're not from the same house, like, let's be real.
Yeah, who cares, it's just the same thing.
My favorite part of this chapter is, like, it should have been really obvious that something was up with Moody, because he's like, I think someone probably bewitched it and put Harry's name in under a fake
takes a really powerful thing
just so that he'd be the only one that would get picked.
That's very specific, obvious. Moody.
Harry's name in the Goblet of Fire.
Yeah, but okay, so I actually had a note on that because it's obviously Barty Crouch Jr. that puts his name in. And like, I was like, why is he hinting that like exactly how it happened? But then I think it was just because he wanted them to stop fighting.
That's his whole thing, though, right? He's hiding in plain sight. Yeah. Like he's being so obviously weird that. no one would suspect him. And of course, like, I think Mad-Eye's reputation is just so unassailable.
Exactly. But his reputation is so crazy that at this point, he could literally say, like, you know, I'm actually Barty Crouch Jr., and people would be like, okay, Mad-Eye, you know.
All right, go back with your dustbins. Chill out, buddy.
Yeah. No, but I think it was also just because if they had been arguing about it just a little bit longer, they probably would have been like, but what happens if the champion doesn't compete in the Triwizard tournament? And then everyone would be like, nothing.
Yeah. I mean, they really should have had, like, an investigation, right? Someone should have looked into this.
Mad-Eye puts it to bed. He's like, oh, someone put Harry's name in on that, and the end, and now we can move on with our lives and get Harry killed, rather than thinking about why this happened and what would happen if Harry didn't compete, because it's just kind of, he gives them the answer so that they can move on.
Yeah, well, couldn't he just show up to every challenge and then just forfeit and walk away or something?
Yeah, he could. But then
he could have had the opposite effect, though. Like, if he's saying probably someone put it in so that because they want to use the tournament to kill him, well, the obvious answer to me to that is, well, then he won't compete.
Like, I think the obvious answer is, hey, someone tries to kill Harry every year, it's okay.
Yeah.
It's part of the deal.
Yeah, he'll figure it out.
Yeah, the part that I struggle with most is Harry even thinks in this chapter about how Voldemort is plotting to murder him. He remembers that. Maybe let's go tell Dumbledore about that he's actually, like, literally plotting to murder me right now.
Dumbledore probably knows, honestly. Dumbledore,
he probably does. He doesn't care.
Yeah, Dumbledore's like, we gotta wait a couple more years till you're smart enough.
He's not ready.
I don't think Dumbledore knew that Harry had that dream where he heard Voldemort.
He doesn't really know.
So that could have been a useful thing to say.
Oh, yeah,
they're
for
not
sure.
really bros yet, though. Like, I think
there's a lot of purposeful, like, not I don't know how, I can't think of the word, but it's like that Bertha Jorkins or whatever her name is. Like, they're just like, oh, she's been missing for 3 months. It's okay. Oh, someone is probably trying to kill Harry. It's okay. Like, there's a lot of, in this book, just dismissal to make the plot work, I guess. Like,
Yeah.
It kind of reads fine for me. I mean, we can joke about it.
In Deathly Hallows, like, Rowling felt bad about how, like, Dumbledore treats Harry and puts him in danger, and so it's like, now when I read this, like, I just imagine he's back there being like, Harry's a Horcrux, it's fine.
Yeah. No, I think
he has more lines.
It was all planned from the beginning. No, I think the flippancy of everyone in the wizarding world, like, I think it's fun. Like, I think it adds to the because, like, I just think of the wizarding world as very silly, so I think if it was a little bit more serious, like, I would maybe not enjoy it as much, and but it is a little head scratching.
And we do have the benefit of hindsight and like this full context that these characters don't have, like, they're not seeing things the same way we are, which I you know, it's credible to me.
Yeah. I also think that it pairs well with the utter denial that characterizes book 5. Because I think, like, you know, if you had people who were actually, like, up and paying attention and being like, this suspicious thing, we should treat as suspicious and, like, deal with it, I don't think those same people would be like, Voldemort can't be back. Look, the sun is shining, you know, like, stuff like that they do all throughout book 5, and, you know, which is the whole point of that book. So I think it does kind of go along with the whole, like, wizards are a little stupid, and also be very, very willing to accept convenient untruths if it makes their lives easier.
Yes.
Which is not exclusively a wizard thing.
Yeah, I was going to say that. True. You know, like, it's
very
like,
true.
It's, I think that we like to think that we're not like that, but I probably have done that millions of times, and obviously it's just something that happens. I think that's all I have for this chapter. If anyone can think of anything else, but that's all I wrote down. I just said.
I really like the American chapter art. I'll paste it into the.
Oh yeah, I like it too.
Because this is, I think, one of the last times where we get Harry feeling like really quite young, and like overwhelmed by his argument. Like, there's a line where, like, he's looking at the other three champions and he's like, oh my god, they're all so tall, and I was like, oh, my baby, we're only 14.
yeah, this is really a low point for Harry. We of course get a lot of low points later, but he's just so estranged from everyone at this point, and that's the one thing he can normally count on, is having the support of his friends. And of course, Ron here, we have one of his big breaks away from Harry because he's jealous of, as we see, all the glory and the fame and the attention that Harry constantly gets, which is totally reasonable. I totally get it from Ron's point of view. But
no, he's really a little shit.
He is terrible to Harry here, is what I was going to say. Like, he really is really mean to him here.
It's disappointing, even though I agree that it is understandable, because it's the first time that Harry has, like, really needed Ron's help in a way that would be challenging to Ron. Like, Ron knows that Harry is not the guy opening the Chamber of Secrets, you know, so he, like, it's not a reach for him to be nice to him when the rest of the school is crapping on him. I think this is, like, the first time that, like, you know, Ron, what Ron wants out of life is actively contrasted by what Harry is getting, and he definitely falls down on that test as he does several times. I mean, I think it's very human.
And I think the good thing too is this has been building through the book so far, like through the whole book so far. We've been getting all these little points of frustration for Ron of seeing how he is inferior in these different ways. He doesn't have the same kind of, you know, monetary things that Harry has available to him, and he doesn't have the same, you know, skills, talents, etc., or just the attention and fame. Like, I totally get his frustration as, like, a 14-year-old kid of, like, feeling like I'm constantly overshadowed by my friend. Like, I know it's very, it's like he should have been able to look past it, but like you say, he's human and he's making a mistake here, and he, you know, eventually learns his lesson. But it's credible to me.
I do think it's an interesting contrast, not Ron and Harry's relationship, but Hermione and Harry's relationship in this book and in the seventh book when they don't have Ron, because I feel like not Harry thrives when Ron's gone, obviously, but like he and Hermione seem to be very close and have a very strong connection. And in this book, without Ron, Harry's just like, Hermione's fine, but, you know, it's very interesting that he needs the dynamic that they have in the two different books. And I think it's an age thing, obviously, because Harry's a 14-year-old boy, so he doesn't have this emotional maturity. Yeah, that's what he said. He needs his best friend. And it's like, well, isn't Hermione one of your best friends? But it's like, no, in this moment, he needs his best, like, guy friend, you know. Or Hermione having to be in the middle of this.
Seriously.
I do really think he needs both of them, and I think we see, you know, there are points where Hermione's kind of less available to him than he needs as well, and like they just both provide things that Harry needs as far as him being the center of the universe.
No, I mean, the story, like, obviously the ideal,
both relationships are important.
No, obviously the ideal is Harry and I mean Ron and Hermione, but it was something I thought of.
So Michal, you have us for the last three chapters of our section.
Yes. So first we have chapter 18, The Weighing of the Wands. Harry is relieved to learn that Hermione believes he did not put his name in the goblet, but basically everyone else hates him. Hermione explains that Ron is jealous of Harry, which Harry is not sympathetic to, and at her urging, Harry writes to Sirius. Before potions, Malfoy starts Malfoying, and he and Harry duel. This results in what might be Snape's worst moment as a teacher ever, when Hermione's teeth are hit with an engorgement charm, and he says, I see no difference. And I remembered this line this time, but last time I read this book, I had not remembered it, and I actively gasped. And he should be fired. I mean, it's just like, fire this man. I don't care. I don't care what he's doing. Fire him. Anyway.
Yeah, I did not remember that at all.
Neither did I.
Same thing. I was like, oh my god.
Unacceptable.
So low. Harry is called away from potions for the wand weighing ceremony, where he meets the reporter Rita Skeeter and her quick quotes quill. Rita is rather unfortunately described as having mannish hands, which, even though Rita is a piece of work, it's not the greatest look. Nope. Harry's wand passes Ollivander's test, and later that night he receives an answer from Sirius setting a time to meet by the Gryffindor fire. So not too much. I mean, you know, the wand weighing ceremony takes up a lot of time, but not that much actually happens. Like, it's kind of like, all right, yep, your wand's good. All right. Yeah.
How does he know that the wands are good? Like, he makes water come out or flowers or something. Like,
well, like Cedric's got that thick 12-inch wand. And you can tell it's rigid.
I think Crumbs is very rigid.
Yeah. He can tell they're good.
No, I had not been picking up on any of this, like, puberty stuff that Michal was talking about earlier with the Scroots, but this, I was like, this is just a dick-measuring competition.
Pretty much. I don't know why they do that. Like, why do they do this? Like, what's the point of this ceremony? I guess just tradition.
Maybe so nobody has a split wand like Ron's and fucks up, I don't know, in the second book.
Like, it's equality of chances, you know? If someone is, like, didn't have the money to replace their wand,
just making sure no one has the Elder Wand.
It's like a test to find the Elder Wand.
Exactly.
It's right there in Dumbledore's hand. Right there.
Behind his back.
It's also, like, I do actually deeply kind of enjoy all of it. I don't love Ollivander as a character, but I love him, like, being unable to not shade the other wand makers. He's like, oh, I wouldn't use Vila Harrods too. Oh, well, if that works for you. And like, oh, Grigorovich, yes, he's good, but not quite what I, you know. And I love it. And it's also fun. The name drop of Grigorovich, which turned out to be quite important later.
Very important. Of course, J.K. Rowling has this master plan, dropping all these hints very early.
Also, Rita Skeeter.
Ugh. Yes, Rita Skeeter.
I just don't under the article that, like, is it just her quick quotes quill, or is it all quick quotes quills? And just, there's so many ethical issues, and I understand that we're supposed to be frustrated because of, like, her ethics and how she publishes him, but oh my god, I'm so frustrated with, like, the article and just how nothing that Harry says is accurate. It just, oh my god.
With the quill, I think it adapts to the personality of the person who owns it.
Yeah,
because
she sucks on the end of that quill.
Yeah.
Really hard.
Whoa. Oh, she does, yeah. Wow. Good point, Recall.
Listen, I'm just saying what happened.
Oh my god.
Okay.
Did ink come out?
I'm Shut curious, up. As a member of the media, what you feel about this portrayal.
I don't have quite the same perspective that I once did on Rita Skeeter. Not as much this book, but in the next book, there's when she's all disgraced and Hermione, like, wrangles her into writing the piece on Harry for the Quibbler, and Hermione's like, oh, no, you're not going to get paid. And I'm like, excuse me? She's
getting paid in exposure.
Yeah. Right, just for exposure.
Is she an intern?
Isn't that most writing gigs, though?
Oh, God. I don't know. I feel like... I like the way Rita Skeeter is deployed in certain ways, because she is, like, an interesting and new kind of irritant in Harry's life that, like, he hasn't had to deal with before. You know, and when we're talking about, like, fame and dealing with fame, I think that Rowling would take that as an important part of that experience, dealing with the press. You know, she's definitely awful and remains awful and gets even worse. She remains evil, like, through the seventh book. But I don't know.
The weird thing at that point is how accurate her story on Dumbledore actually turns out to be in some ways.
That's true.
Yeah. But that's only after, like, she drugs What's-Her-Face and gets all that knowledge out of her, which is kind of a violation, too.
A little bit, maybe, yeah.
Oh, she's wildly unethical. She does not have any standards.
Alrighty, I can move on, I think, next one.
Yes, okay. So, chapter 19, The Hungarian Horntail. Harry's life still sucks, and it sucks more because Rita's extremely liberty-taking article has been released, claiming that Harry cries about his parents and is dating Hermione. Harry's fight with Ron continues, even though he admits to himself that Hermione is just not as fun of a friend as his bro. A few days before the task, Harry and Hermione go to Hogsmeade, with Harry hiding under the invisibility cloak. At the Three Broomsticks, Hagrid, alerted to Harry's presence by Moody's really kind of alarming ability to see through anything, tells Harry to meet him at his hut at midnight with the invisibility cloak, which is just before meeting Sirius. It turns out that Hagrid wants Harry to third wheel on his date with Madame Maxime, on which he shows them the bunch of innocent, stressed-out mother dragons who will comprise the first task. Racing back to the common room to talk to Sirius, Harry runs into Karkaroff, who is also spying on the dragons, and Sirius appears in the fire and is actually less concerned about the dragons than he is about the one former Death Eater running around Hogwarts, who is Karkaroff. Only Karkaroff. There are no other Death Eaters running around Hogwarts. However, Sirius does correctly figure out that Bertha Jorkins was killed by Voldemort, thus beginning the whole Triwizard plot.
Sirius is about to tell Harry how to beat the dragon when Ron comes down from the tower. Harry, furious at having his godfather session cut short, throws a Potter Really Stinks badge that hits Ron on the forehead, and in a really high-level burn, he says, "You might even have a scar now if you're lucky. That's what you want, isn't it?"
Ouch.
Yeah.
So, conjunctivitis is what Sirius was gonna fucking recommend to Harry? Conjunctivitis spell? These books sometimes are just too stupid. It's when you have poop on your hands and you rub your eye and it gets infected.
It's blind the dragon, basically.
Yeah.
It's not just poop, though. There's a lot of other things. That can
There's all kinds of conjunctivitis.
Adam's like, I want medicine.
There's all kinds of things.
Wait, are you joking, or is that actually what Sirius was going to suggest?
Yeah, because that's what Crumb does. Because apparently a dragon...
Oh! I'm sorry. I'm actually dumb.
It's a good plan. I was surprised at how useless that conversation was. Like, Harry doesn't really act on anything that's said there. I mean, I guess he thinks Karkaroff for a bit. It's not really a useful dialogue they had.
Well, it's just more of a red herring to throw us off of the
scent. Yeah.
Well, also, the risk to have that dialogue was so great. Like, you would have figured it would have been a little more... something to go on there.
I'm surprised he was able to they were able to coordinate this meeting when Sirius literally was like relying on these people not coming back to their house.
Yeah, well, nobody's ever in the common room later than Harry, Ron, and Hermione, even as first years.
Sirius had broken into someone's house and he was like, I don't know how long I have before they get back. So I'm like, how did you even coordinate this meeting days in advance? Just have a stakeout track.
But Sirius is not a planner. He makes things up as he goes along.
He's a go with the flow guy.
Or you couldn't just use flu powder in a normal fire. So I was going to say he should steal flu powder and break into a Muggle house, but yeah,
it's got to be connected.
Yes,
it's just funny at this point how horribly corrupt this tournament ends up being. Like, everyone is cheating constantly, and Ludo is like betting on Harry as a judge.
Yeah,
oh my god.
And Hagrid just being like, oh, Madame Maxime told me she wasn't going to tell her champion.
Ah, Hagrid. Oh, man.
Yeah, who was it that was like, cheating's part of the tournament?
That is.
It's like baseball. Keeping with the metaphor.
Yeah. There's an interesting line in this chapter where Harry talks about how, like, you know, he doesn't miss Ron, and he's like, well, that's not true because we're spending a lot more time in the library and a lot less time laughing when Hermione is his best friend. And, like, I find that, like, both sad because, like, Hermione can't change that. Like, she is literally being the best and most supportive friend she could possibly be here. But at the same time, there's just, like, something, you know, she's not Ron. And, like, they like you were saying, Zach, they do both contribute, like, different things that Harry needs in his life, and when he has one and is lacking the other, I think you see that actually a lot in the sixth book, because like Harry does a lot of idiotic things in the sixth book that I don't think he would do if Ron and Hermione weren't fighting and Harry sort of had taken Ron's side more or less, even though Ron is legendarily awful in the sixth.
Oh my god, I can't wait.
I like Ron a lot. He's a very human character. He is the worst sometimes.
Oh, yeah, he's awful.
Yeah, so Sirius is also... He totally figures out. He's, like, he's completely right about Bertha Jorkins and being found by Voldemort in Albania and, you know, have the ministry information taken from her mind and then murdered. So that's interesting. It, you know, I do... I like this book in that, like, everybody kind of has a piece of the puzzle, you know? Yeah. Like, everybody knows that one part of this is wrong, but nobody's putting it together. And, like, because Moody is, like, right under their noses, and that's everybody's blind spot, they're incapable of doing it. So I think, like, and that's why the shock at the end of the book, I think, is so awesome when Moody takes Harry when Barty Crouch Jr. takes Harry to his office, like, on top of just being, like, another stomach punch after that entire experience with Prairie and Cantatum, like, it's the last piece falling into place in the last place that anyone thought it was going to. Mm. And, yeah, I have, like, a lot of issues with, like, some of the...
necessary things in this book. Like, obviously, Moody's teaching them about the unforgivable curses because J.K. Rowling needs to introduce the unforgivable curses, and they don't learn the summoning charm because Harry needs to learn the summoning charm in 5 minutes in the next chapter. But, like, I think there's a lot of really interesting mystery writing going on, and, like, kind of just human foibles preventing the all of that being solved.
Yeah, and it's so demonstrative, right, of how good this plan was. Like, the choice to pick Moody was so perfect for all these reasons you described. And yeah, it leads to this, just the end of this book in general was just absurdly good.
Yeah, I love the end of the book. Yeah. So many feels.
I agree.
All right. In the meantime, anything else on 19?
Oh, I will just note that Harry's line to Ron, I think, actually does get through to him. Because he notes that he doesn't hear him come out to bed, and they don't really interact after this. So I think that actually does knock some sense into Ron and being like, wait a second, what exactly am I jealous of? And like, obviously it doesn't resolve the whole problem, but I think he's not like completely incognizant of the fact that like he's jealous of Harry for a lot of really shitty things that Harry can't control and would return if he could.
Yeah, I think he sees there how upset Harry is. Like, I think he's thinking, like, Harry's living the high life right now, basically. Or at least that's the delusion that he has. And he kind of sees, like, yeah, Harry is not in good shape at this point. And I think the combination of that and, of course, seeing how horrible it would have been if he had been in the tournament in the next chapter is enough to shake him out of it. So let's go ahead and get to that. Our last chapter of the day, chapter 20.
Chapter 20, the first task. Harry and Hermione start ransacking the library for ideas on how to beat the dragon, but are forced to leave when Crumb returns again, followed by his fan club. Why is he there? I don't know. The next day, Harry tells a skeptical Cedric about the dragons, and Moody, quote-unquote, impressed by his decency, takes Harry to his office, which is filled with a 7-locked trunk and a ton of dark detectors, many of which Moody has disabled for some reason. The professor offers very strong hint as to how Harry can complete the task, and he actually kind of slips a little bit because he's like, put it together, it's not that difficult, you idiot, basically. Harry realizes that he needs to use a summoning charm to retrieve his broom from the castle. Hermione dedicates the next day of her life to teaching him the charm, which Harry finally masters. After losing a good chunk of Tuesday to wild nerves, it's finally time for the task. The champions draw their dragons and the order of competition, and Harry obviously draws the most dangerous Hungarian horntail. The task is to retrieve the golden egg from the innocent and protective mama dragons without dying. Harry also rejects Bagman's offer of advice, and the task begins. Cedric, Fleur, and Crumb all eventually retrieve their eggs, and then it is Harry's turn. He is almost too nervous to see, but performs the Axio charm, and his broom arrives. While flying, Harry realizes that he is no longer afraid and is able to use Quidditch tactics to lure the innocent mama dragon away from her clutch of eggs and retrieve the golden egg. After the task, Harry and Ron reconcile, and Harry is scored excellently, except for a little blip on the radar from Karkaroff, tying in first place with Crumb. Bagman tells the champions to uncover the clue for the second task in their egg, and Harry tells Rita Skeeter to go fuck herself. Guys, I feel really bad for the dragon.
Yeah, well, the part that got me was the part with Crumb where the dragon smashes their own eggs.
Yeah.
You just are playing with this dragon for fun, for tournament purposes, and you just killed their kids.
Yeah.
Although, okay,
wizards are really the worst.
No, I was actually really sad about this too, but so I used to have female pet birds, and then they would lay unfertilized eggs and still be like very protective of them, so I was like, maybe they're just unfertilized,
they're about to be an omelet.
Yeah, you can just think of that, like that she just lays eggs that aren't fertilized, so those eggs didn't have babies in them, and now you feel better.
Okay.
Yeah.
No, but, like, the whole thing with the dragons is, like, the first time you see them, they're like, gosh, they're so upset. Like, why are they so upset? Because we have to stun them all into unconsciousness. You know, it's like, I don't know. This is a little, you know, with Hermione going on about SPEW, like, I think that there's a certain amount of, like, cruelty to animals element, not in SBW, but in this, that is sort of a parallel to the way wizards are comfortable treating non-human creatures.
So that was something I had a issue with also with Hermione, is because like Hagrid tells them that like originally they had like hundreds of Scroots, and now there's 20 left, and Hermione does not seem to care at all. She cares about the elves. I don't know. There's just like a lot of there's just a lot of casual animal cruelty. Like the spiders. It's just
I'll give them a pass on the scroots, although it is kind of brutal when Hermione says they should stamp on a lot of them. But like, yeah, the scroots really do seem to be pointless. But yeah, I don't know. It's interesting that the dragon, like Hagrid's kind of the only one who's like, dragons are people, which is not entirely right either. But back to the task, I guess. I really do love the writing when Harry's flying. Like, I mean, I love the writing before also with the, like the intensity of the nerves that he's feeling. And yeah. Like, I still find it very, very visceral and just sort of like, you know, I don't have that sense of nerves anymore reading it. Cause obviously I know what's going to happen like intimately, but it's
such a good rendering of that feeling though, that you can kind of, you know, place your own experiences where you've been in these moments of nervous anticipation onto onto what's being described here.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then like the solidarity that the champions kind of have never had, and then they finally find kind of in the tent together when they're all just like sick with anxiety and kind of are all on an equal playing field.
It's really the first part where you kind of get like the humanized version of Fleur and Crumb to an extent.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, this part's really good, and I think it's such smart writing from like a plot standpoint in terms of the emotional arc of the story, because of course through these chapters we've been through, it's kind of been an emotional descent for Harry up to this point. He's just been dealing with all these awful things, and it's been getting worse and worse. But just having this like crescendo, this sudden upswing, like you feel that so strongly, and that's just so effective and such good writing. Like I always admire like the same feeling I get every time I read this. This just like feeling of, oh, things are better now, and it culminates so well. At least for the time being, it culminates so well with the like just telling Rita Skeeter to like get the fuck out of here. It's such a good cap on that.
Yeah, and the you know, Ron's revelation, I think it's like, it's definitely valid to say that like Ron, regardless of what Harry needs to hear, should have apologized more and been like, hey, I was a total idiot. But the way he comes in and is just like, somebody's trying to do you in, mate. Like, it's such a release. It's such a, like...
Yeah, it's so honest.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah. Like, everybody's on the same page again. Everybody's, like, back to normal. And, you know, Rowling does this a lot, I think, with, like the chapter when Hermione punches Malfoy is very much like that in book three. And then book five doesn't really have a moment like this. Like, the beginning of the year is just a descent, you know? But book seven does, because like the last time I read seven, I was just like, oh my God, I'm like going crazy reading like the four chapter span or something when Ron leaves. And then that also culminates in such a great, relieving and cathartic moment. So I think that is something like the dynamics of friendship and the way that affects your mood. I think it's something she has a really good handle on.
Book five has the Weasleys busting out of Hogwarts, so that's a great...
Yes, that's true. No, there are definitely bright spots in book five, and like the, but it's kind of like Harry has to make those, you know, like he has to make the DA in order to find, you know, that kind of camaraderie, because otherwise it's just like a relentless onslaught from Umbridge and, you know, being...
And none of those feel to me, and this might just be me, they don't feel the same as this. They don't feel like that full release of tension. Like, I feel like the tension is still there. It might be, like, a brief reprieve from that, but this feels like such a full, like, unclenching of that, of everything that he's been going through up to this point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, so it is more youthful, right? Like, you don't necessarily get that kind of relief when you're an adult.
Good point, too, yeah. There's always that just stress under the surface doesn't go away. Good point for sure. And it does demonstrate how he's changed and grown as a character.
Adulting is the worst.
So true. All right. Well, do you want to end on that point? Is there anything else anyone wants to say on this chapter before you wrap up this podcast?
I just think it's a little ridiculous that this tournament has to last the whole year.
Yes.
And they have three tasks.
It gets. It's. We're gonna see a lot of that in our next section. Like the second task lasts forever. It takes so long to get up to that point. But, like
everyone's so excited about the tournament, and I'm like, it's kind of boring.
It's also kind of absurd, right? Because the students from Beaubaton and Durmstrang, like, what are they supposed to do? I'm guessing they are joining classes and still learning stuff, but they are not following their usual curriculum that they have in their own schools. And these schools are going on without their headmasters for a while. It's just it doesn't make much sense.
Yeah, I mean, I guess Karkaroff and Maxime could, like, Karkaroff's not doing this because I don't think he gives a fuck, but, like, I guess Maxime could, like, you know, leave the Hogwarts grounds and apparate back, if you can do that, to France, I don't know, or take a port key or whatever to check in on the school she has left behind. But yeah, it definitely is, like, are you guys just living in a carriage, like, the whole year? It doesn't seem like it's that roomy.
By the way, you're just reminded me of Karkaroff.
It's bigger on the part inside.
The part where the other kid is like, "Headmaster, may I have some water?" She's like, "Fuck off, idiot!
I didn't talk to you."
Crumb's the only one who matters. So funny.
Yeah, isn't he giving him booze for a cough or something?
Yeah.
It's like, I have a cough.
Mulled wine from the kitchens. Yeah. Karkaroff is, like, awful. So like, he's a character who has, like, very... I don't honestly see any... because he is the red herring of this book for in a large part. Like, he kind of takes Snape's place in that way. But he actually isn't, like, that evil, objectively. You know, like, we don't actually know any of the, like, crimes that he was involved in as a Death Eater. He just seems like a kind of pathetic, nasty guy, but he is so deeply nasty and unpleasant, and just, like, again, kind of like Snape, like, how do people like this get away with shit? And, you know, it's kind of like, oh yeah, well, of course he went to Russia to, like, be a teacher.
I think that's it. Anything else anyone wants to say?
I'm excited for I'm excited for the next set of chapters, but I'm really excited for the set of chapters after that.
So let's, let's, like, hash this out now, because I think we might want to actually, like, we've been doing 10 chapters at a time up to this point. I think for the next parts, we should split those into, like, smaller parts, because the last few chapters, I think we want to spend more time on than we normally would. So that's probably what I'll end up doing.
So you want to do, like, to chapter 30 in the next one, and then...
Let me look at the list right now.
30 is the pensive, and then 31 is the third task.
Yeah, I think, let's see... It might make sense, yeah, to do third task through the end as its own set.
Yeah, I think so.
That probably works.
Sweet.
I still don't really understand Prayer and Cantatum, I gotta say. But
I don't either. Doesn't really make sense. We'll get to that.
It makes me angry. Alrighty. That no one can die and, like, rest in peace. Like, either they're trapped in a fucking painting or in someone's wand to be summoned back whenever happens. Like,
with all those things, they're not the real person, right? They're like an image, an after image of that person. Image,
yeah. No, they're sentient.
I mean...
No, I think they're just representations.
No, like, what's his name asks Harry to bring his body back so his father can see him or whatever.
Yeah, but Cedric just died. Like, I think that's closer to an actual...
So there's still a little bit of life.
Yeah.
I think they're just, like, they represent the personality of the person. The question is, like, how do they know certain things? I guess that's a weird thing, but I think they're not the actual, like, person's consciousness. They're
stored in the memory of the wand, and you kind of hope that he's going to kill more people so that you can just be erased from the memory and finally gone.
The wand with death. Five memories.
Yeah. So.
Alrighty. Alright, well, we'll wrap it there. Another really good Harry Potter cast. Thank you all so very much for joining me for this. It was a lot of fun, as always, and we'll hash out the exact chapters, but of course, in our next reread, we'll be continuing the Goblet of Fire, probably the up through to the point where the third task begins, so that'll be a fun set for sure. Alrighty, thank you all so much again for joining me for this. If you want to check out more Vassals of Kingsgrave, you can do so at vokpodcast.com. You can check us out on Twitter, on Facebook, on YouTube, all those places. And if you want to leave us a review on iTunes, that is always appreciated. Thank you all so very much again for joining me for this, and we will be back next time for some more fun content. See ya.
That was fun, guys. Thanks.
Yes. Thank you.
Sunday.
Sunday fun day.
Is it Sunday fun day?
I don't know.
I wish.
I spent this whole morning reading Harry Potter, so I was having a good time.
Yeah. Hey, guys.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello. Bonjour, okay, Marie.
Salut, Matt. I read almost everything today, so I was into it. I was reading it on the subway, and I was like, half, like, I don't care, I'm reading Harry Potter, and don't you dare thinking anything about it, and half embarrassed. I don't know.
I read, like, one chapter last night, but I mostly watched BoJack Horseman, and then I was just, like, really sad about BoJack ending, so I read, like, one chapter to cheer myself up, but then I went to bed.
Fair enough.
I'm not even sure. I don't think I even finished, actually, the whole... I think maybe I'm into the last chapter of our reading today, but I'm not finished.
I'm pretty sure you know what happens.
Yeah, I think I'm fine with the events themselves. And anyway, I'm not even remembering. Like, it's not like reading it gives me a real perspective on the writing because I'm reading it in French.
Interesting.
So,
what's the name of Beauxbatons in French?
Well, exactly that.
Same thing. Beauxbatons.
It's French, you know.
Where is that school? No one knows. It could be France.
What place could it be?
Is it like it's in like Marseille though, or whatever? Because they like have bouillabaisse.
They eat bouillabaisse, and it's
and they wear light clothes and all that.
Yeah, but that's actually like I realized that in French, Madame Maxime has like they. It's weird the way they do her accent because it's already in French.
Oh.
So she's the one having a weird accent, but yeah. It's like it doesn't make sense.
Well, it's like I guess it's like Hagrid, because Hagrid has like a accent, but he's like already speaking like British English.
Yeah, but
it's Cockney.
It's like, I don't know.
Weirdly written French in my French edition. Whenever Madame Maxime is talking, and
just pretend she's from Quebec.
Yeah, that's it.
So does Beauxbatons mean lovely sticks? What does that mean?
It means pretty wands.
Yeah, basically.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense.
Do we have any Germans here that can translate derm? Dermstrang?
I always thought that, I mean, like, is it German? I thought it was more like a Slavic word.
Yeah, me too.
All right, to the interwebs.
But, yeah, yes, I thought it was...
Someone will have dissected it.
I thought the same. I thought they were in some kind of Nordic country.
Yeah, I always thought that they were in, like, either Scandinavia or, like, some, like, just, like...
Somewhere really cold.
Yeah, just somewhere in wherever, but, like, the school is more affiliated with, like, less Scandinavia and more, like, Slavic region, like, Eastern Europe.
Yeah, that makes sense. Do we know Dermstrang?
Honestly...
So, I got Dermstrang Institute, by the way. Is one of the three largest wizarding schools in Europe, the other two being Hogwarts and Beauxbatons. Located in the far north of the continent, the school is willing to accept international students as far afield as Bulgaria, because we know Crumb, right?
Yeah.
having existed since 1294, Dermstrang is one of the three schools that compete in the Triwizard Tournament, blah, blah, blah. It's notorious for prominently featuring dark
arts. Oh, it is German.
Curriculum.
Dermstrang comes from a spoonerism of Sturm und Drang, which is German expression meaning turmoil.
Yeah, it refers to a specific literary current, Sturm und Drang.
Yeah, an artistic movement of the late 1700s.
Really. Yeah.
Interesting.
Bully base.
So speaking of young adult fiction, there's like a new Hunger Games book coming out, right?
Really? Like in the Hunger Games series?
What?
Yeah, prequel.
Ooh, that sounds really interesting, actually. Is it, like, about, like, how Panem got the way that it was?
No, I think...
So, at first, they had an impeachment inquiry, and then the ruler was...
the apocalypse that, like, killed everyone in Panem.
That was a joke by Matt.
I know.
I think...
But, like, I'm interested now.
I don't know how much we know. I think it would be, like, an earlier Hunger Games.
Oh, yeah, it's 64 years... Oh, no, but it tells the story of the Dark Days. I'm on Wikipedia now. Oh, it's coming out soon. It's in May. Released in May.
Yeah.
Yeah, nice little cash grab for them. Make another movie. Cool. Call it a day.
I mean, honestly, though, I went through this Hunger Games phase, like, way after the Hunger Games was over, where I just, like, was very fascinated by, like, the lore. So I bought, like, a fan-made book about, like, the history of Panem. and it was very fascinating. I am actually like very interested in this because I like post-apocalyptic things.
Where's Greg?
Bully base.
This is my second podcast of the day, guys.
Oh wow! Were you on the reread?
No, that was yesterday, and I missed it because I was bad.
What was the other one today?
We were doing N with an E earlier morning. Early this morning, 12 hours ago.
Right, it'd be like the middle of the night 11 hours ago.
Yeah.
I was late at 8 a.m. I was listening to someone talk about that show, and I showed a clip from the show, and I heard her voice, and she has a really subtle Canadian accent, and it kind of made me mad because I started noticing Canadian accents more. And now when I'm watching American show things that take place in America and someone has a Canadian accent, I get really frustrated.
Yeah, sorry. We can't all be an American accent, see? We got a double-double from Tim Hortons.
Ugh, gross. I hate Tim Hortons. I was at, when I was in New Brunswick, I ran into a bunch of Americans, myself, but, I've been indoctrinated. And these Americans were like, oh my gosh, we're so excited to try Tim Hortons. And I was like, don't go. It's a disappointment. It's not worth it. Go home and go to Dunkin' Donuts.
It's a disappointment. Oh yeah. My goodness.
They're Timbits.
That's heresy.
Timbits
are. Don't put this in. We'll lose all our Canadian listeners.
Timbits are literally too nice to leave us. Timbits are literally the worst. They're not even. They don't even have sprinkles.
You are killing me right now.
They call them Jimmy's.
I have no idea.
No, Timbits have no sprinkles.
They also have Tim Hortons in certain states in the U.S. now.
Yeah, they have them in Michigan, in northern Michigan.
Which is basically just Canada.
Yeah. But, I lived in Michigan for 9 years. I never went to northern Michigan one time.
Donut holes, you know. Yeah. Everybody loves Tim Hortons.
Never went to the UP?
The only time I went to northern Michigan was when I was driving to Canada. And we stopped at
I've been to Canada more times than I've been to northern Michigan. So.
I mean, same.
Well, yeah.
bully base.
Thanks, everybody.
Yeah, thank you, guys.
Appreciate everyone taking the time to do all this reading and to do this podcast.
Dude, it was the 100th reread yesterday.
Yeah, crazy, right?
Wow. Oh my goodness.
Five more, right?
Not many left until there's more books.
Yeah.
I've got to say about Harry Potter. When I grabbed the book, I realized why I wanted to read them in French. Or at least why I don't bother finding a PDF in English. It's just because seeing the book and taking it in my hand and everything, I'm like, it's
nostalgia.
Such warm memories and nostalgia.
Yeah.
I remember reading book 5, I think, together with someone else, and we were sitting in class and we were at different moments in the book, and so it was open in two places with one of us holding the pages between. Aww. And we were both reading it at the same time. I have no idea whatsoever who this person is, but I remember
that was almost a nice memory.
Yeah. And I remember reading it with someone else. I don't know. I'm wondering if it's not book 4, but I don't think so, because it was really a big book, and that corresponds to book 5 more. Anyway, so yeah.
That's so cute. Yeah.
No, I also I picked it up and I was like, I had actually been reading Gideon the Ninth, which is the darkest. It's pitch black. It's it's not a fuzzy book in any sense of the word.
Harrowhawk.
Yeah, seriously. So I'm actually not sure I'm going to keep going. I probably will, because everybody says it's so good, but whatever. But then thinking of Harry Potter is
I don't think everyone says it's so good, to be clear. Maybe that's just Greg.
No, I mean, I've heard, I got a ton of press emails about that, and they were trying to, you know, and it got a lot of press, and
I didn't quite feel that reading it, personally. It was fun, but I didn't feel this is some real good shit.
Yeah, I mean, it's very creative, and the writing is pretty audacious, it's a cool idea. But I do kind of wonder if the, and this is not fair of me to say because I'm two chapters into it, but the line about how she gathered her all of her things and her dirty magazines and whatever, and I feel like they do a lot, they lean a lot on that dirty magazines line because it's so unusual, and it's I get it, it's a good hook, but also there needs to be more than just that. So
You know, I had the exact same thought. Like, it feels like a lot of, even the reactions to the book are like, oh, look, sexy lesbian necromancer is like, is probably more.
Nice.
Say what now?
Yeah, that's like
the tagline. Yeah, a big part of the selling point is that it's a lesbian romance. I assume it's a romance. I don't know.
Bully base.
I'm also just reading the Witcher books on audio, and those are like a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Are they good? Because I'm facing the same thing then with Game of Thrones, where the show is out, and I'm like, yes, but I want to read the books first, which I did with Game of Thrones. And with The Witcher, I don't know if I actually want to do it. But if they're good, I will probably.
Yeah, I mean, so I saw the first season before and I haven't played the games or anything. So I definitely was like, my introduction was through the show, which I actually thought was a good thing, because I don't like reading it on audiobook. There's just a lot of stuff in fantasy books that like. It's easy to forget and not pay attention to, because you're not like anchoring the visual word, you know.
Mm-hmm. The show kind of frames all this stuff, and you can get the depth.
Yeah, exactly. And the first season is like most of the stories are in the first book, so I kind of was like, oh, I can like pay half of a mind to this, and you know, still kind of get what's going on. But the characters are really interesting, and I like it's. The tone is really interesting, because like even when like A Song of Ice and Fire is like funny, it's always like a dark, you know, it's all very kind of like in the context of war and mm-hmm. you know, death and whatever. And that stuff is present in the Witcher books, but there's something much more like life affirming about it somehow. Like I think the author just doesn't take it quite as seriously, and yeah, I'm enjoying it a lot. There's a lot of things to kind of like make fun of in a way that you think the author, like I feel like the author would appreciate. So, I am enjoying them.
It's on the list, but I have to read them in French, which is nice, because I like reading in French, and it doesn't happen very often now that I read fantasy in the original language when it's English. So it's. Nice, but almost a bit weird, because I feel like I'm almost only reading in English now.
Well, those books are originally actually in Polish, right?
So I'm not going to read them in Polish, and why would I read them in English if it's a translation?
Right, it's just another translation.
And, you know, it feels like the same kind of like lords and knights and, you know, dwarves and elves and whatever stuff, you know, as A Song of Ice and Fire, but at the same time, like, it is from a Polish perspective, which is, you know, it's not going to be 100% the same. And some of the commentary on like marginalized people, you know, like it's very present in the books, and I'm not sure how I feel about it yet, but it's definitely a different perspective than like an American who's like, well, we never had this in our country anyway, you know, as opposed to like somebody from Eastern Europe, right, where this stuff is much more, I think in the culture.
Bully base. Alrighty, okay. Guys.
Okay.
Is anyone doing anything fun for the Superb Owl?
My son is oddly super into it. Like, this year he kind of got into football a little bit, but, like, not a lot. And, like, I guess the kids at school are excited, and, like, the Titans made a playoff run, and he was like, I want them to lose. He's like, I want the Chargers to win. And I'm like, dude, they're not even in the playoffs, man. I had to explain it to him. He doesn't quite get how it works, but he's playing basketball, so he's super into it. And he thinks the 49ers are going to win. He's convinced they're the best team. I don't know why. He has very little to go off of.
Bully base.